Hello, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in New York. Today, we'll be speaking with Claudia Kalb, author of the new book, Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Mind of History's Great Personalities, published in 2016 by National Geographic Society. Claudia Kalb is an award-winning journalist who specializes in the fields of medicine, health, and science, and former senior writer at Newsweek and contributor to publications such as Smithsonian and Scientific American. I'm very glad to have her on the show. Welcome, Claudia.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about the book and what inspired it.
Well, I've always really enjoyed the study of psychology and mental health. And I was a writer at Newsweek for 17 years, where I worked on many stories in the medical field. And mental health always rose to the top. Psychology, the mind, the brain, this great universe that still is so not misunderstood all the time, but just still needs so much exploration. What's going on in there? And I really wanted to get into great depth, which I couldn't really do at the magazine in terms of length, but to get into great depth on this subject and tell stories, because people learn best through storytelling. And what a great opportunity to study the lives of 12 people, tell their stories, better understand them, their internal struggles, their troubles and their triumphs, and educate people about mental health through these very, very human stories. So that was the inspiration. It was tell about people's lives and let's learn about what we all encounter every day with each other, family members, friends, and even ourselves.
You know, I teach psychology and I'm a psychologist myself. So normally, I think people learn about psychology through textbooks and classes and maybe case studies of people who have actually been de-identified. So your approach is quite different because you're taking real people and people that we all know, or that we all know most of them, perhaps. So what is unique then about writing about the psychology of a public figure?
Right. That's a great question. Now, public figures are often known very, very superficially. So Marilyn Monroe, one of the characters in the book. I mean, I think I, for one, and probably a lot of people are very familiar with her public persona, her appearance on stage and what she looked like and sort of that aura that she had and that, you know, sort of sparkling presence. And yet, you know, pull back that curtain and she really struggled so much. She had so many difficulties throughout her life. And I think, you know, telling these stories through public figures gives people an entree. They're interested in these people because they know them at some level. Abraham Lincoln, you know, Betty Ford, George Gershwin, all the people I wrote about, people know at some level, but they don't really, really probably not had the experience of sort of going deep into their lives and their stories. So I think by public figures give you an opportunity to educate in a way that just a random case study in a medical journal is not going to do that. That is a respectable and greatly needed way of educating professionals and better understanding a clinical condition and looking at case studies. But to educate a broader population, to get to readers who are never going to pick up a medical journal, this way of educating is, I think, very inviting and in many ways very comforting because people recognize, wow, these are famous people. I had no idea that they struggle with a lot of the same things I am familiar with or my family members are.
So coming from the world of journalism, how did you become interested in psychology and particularly in, and I don't know what you would call it, but the area of mental health illness or psychopathology? How did you develop a curiosity for that?
Well, you know, at Newsweek, where I was writing, I had worked on many stories about mental health and psychology, and really dating back to my childhood, I was always interested in the mind. I was always interested in people's feelings. I often spent too much time anticipating what somebody might, how somebody might react, or what was somebody thinking. It was something that resonated with me. I thought about it a lot. I was interested in it. I thought about, in fact, going to medical school and maybe studying psychology or psychiatry, but I ended up on the writing track, which was my great love. And I was able in this book and through my other work to really investigate these areas that interest me so much and then write about them. So in that sense, it's something that has always resonated with me. And I just find when you think about, I mean, I wrote many articles about things like heart disease or diabetes or disorders of the physical body that affect so many people. And those are fascinating and important. The brain, though, offers this entree into a universe where there is still so much to learn and there's so much exciting research going on. And there are so many questions. And it's so human. It's all about our lives. And it just captivates me.
Now, in a minute, I want to get into some of these figures and sort of deep dive. But before we do that, was there a particular person that you started researching first? Or did you go about sort of researching them simultaneously? How did that work? How was your process?
Right. I did a lot of simultaneous research because I had a deadline that I had to meet and I needed to gather information pretty much at all times and continue, even if I was perhaps, you know, writing about my chapter on Marilyn Monroe, I was researching another person at the same time or getting inspiration through reading. And I spent a lot of time looking at biographies. I mean, I was in the library looking at biographies of people and trying to get ideas and think about who would be interesting to talk about. And was there a condition that that had been written about already medically by experts that I could explore? So it was a real process of gathering information, talking to experts, getting ideas, you know, diving into historical records, both medical records and old biographies and autobiographies. And I did a lot of that at the same time, kind of juggling it. And I would carve out time for writing when a deadline was coming up for a chapter. So it really, until the end, even the last few, I was still trying to make sure that this was the person I really wanted to write about. And I could have done a few more chapters, but I decided 12 seemed like a good number.
Was there someone who almost made it into the book, but who ended up not?
No, there were a number of people who almost did. And in fact, one of the ones was Van Gogh. I was really interested in him, and particularly thinking about bipolar, which had been raised numerous times. But in fact, a new study or a new meeting has apparently just happened where a number of experts have gathered to talk about Van Gogh. And the conclusion is some kind of psychosis. He didn't make it in, and a couple of others didn't make it in because I just felt I couldn't nail it down well enough, or there wasn't enough information that had already been put forth by the experts.
So I could see that making sure that what you had to say was backed by science, was backed by documented evidence, or maybe in some cases even the figure's own admissions and own speaking about the condition, that was solid.
Right. That was really the driving factor above everything else. Wanted to make sure that I wasn't assigning labels in any kind of flippant way or just sort of out of a box. I mean, that's one of the things I fight against in terms of trying to chip away at stigma, but to do it in a way where these reports had been published. Experts had proposed theories on these figures in the book, or in several cases, they had talked themselves. So Diana, Princess Diana, talked about her bulimia, and Betty Ford spoke openly about addiction. So that was the driving factor. There were other elements that I wanted to make sure made the book interesting and readable. A real evolution in history. So the characters range from 1809, when both Lincoln and Darwin were born on the very same day in February, all the way to the death of Betty Ford. So 200 years, 1800s to 1900s, a real span of history, which also allowed me to kind of look at the evolution of our understanding of the mind and diagnoses and treatment. And then also give people a range of livelihoods to think about. So in each case, the person is doing something different. There's Warhol, the painter. There's Marilyn Monroe, the Hollywood actress. There's Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect. Each one comes from a very different kind of background. And I think that gives a sense to readers, the message being, to some degree, this affects everyone, that troubles in the mind, whatever they may be, and whatever you want to call them, really do affect us all. And so giving people that sense of a diversity within these livelihoods was another goal. And so all of those factored into who I finally selected.
So let's get into some of these folks. Was there someone who was particularly difficult to write about or difficult to find out about?
A lot of them, in some ways, were difficult. So there's 12 people in the book that are profiled, and there's 12 different conditions. Each one is a different condition. One of the ones I wrote about is transgender. And in that case, probably the least known figure named Christine Jorgensen, who was the first widely known American to seek transgender treatment way back in 1950. And that chapter, I would say, was the hardest to write because even now, the language around the condition is changing almost, you know, on a continual basis, how to describe it. There's controversy about whether it belongs in the diagnostic manual or not. And that's a really interesting question in and of itself. Checking back into the history of the evolution of understanding transgender throughout history was challenging because there was a lot of a lot of information to try to find, and then a lot of trying to resolve some of the difficult challenges with language. What do you call it? What is it called today? And what was it called in the past? That was a hard one. Others were more forthcoming in the sense that, let's say, Betty Ford wrote two autobiographies. So there was a lot of information that came directly from her. Frank Lloyd Wright left behind an autobiography and lots of letters and interesting reflections that I could draw on. And as did, for example, Einstein, lots of letters, and people can read these online. And it's so interesting. You get a real perspective on him from his own personal writing, as well as Darwin. And you can read some of Darwin's health history, his own little health journal that he kept. So that it varied from person to person.
So I want to go back to Christine Jorgensen, because I agree with you that she might be the figure who is least recognizable to people. So what do you think people can learn from her story?
No, I think it's such a relevant story today. When Caitlyn Jenner, when her evolution came out and she was now Caitlyn Jenner, the person that we all knew as this athlete, Bruce Jenner in the past, it sort of resonates as this area that's really come to the fore, that's developing and changing in so many ways. But I think people can learn from a story of Christine Jorgensen who goes back decades to me, the bravery with which she confronted her own feelings and her situation. She was somebody who was, as a child, identified with what would have been considered sort of the female kinds of things. I mean, you know, she liked the toys that her sister was playing with. She didn't feel comfortable as a boy. She never did. She didn't like the boys' camp she went to. She had all of these feelings within herself, and yet she had nowhere to turn. She had no contemporary people that she could look at or talk to or go on the internet and call up stories and interviews the way people can today. With her, it was a personal quest, and she was a determined person. She wanted to figure out what was going on and resolve her situation, embrace who she believed she was. And to me, that is a story of just immense bravery, fortitude, and real, just incredible passion for the self and for figuring out, who am I? And even if somebody isn't going to easily tell me who I am, I'm going to keep working at it. And there she was, way back then, taking this trip off. She sailed off to Copenhagen. She found a doctor who was willing to explore all of this with her. She ended up getting treatment, and she lived the rest of her life as a woman. And she also, there was a lot of joking around when she came back to the U.S., in those early years, in the early 50s. And she sort of rose above it by being comfortable with who she was and just going out there and doing her thing. She did some performing and even joked herself, but in a way that made it easier for people to sort of realize she's a human being at the bottom. At the end of the day, that's who she is.
It's such an interesting story because this is someone who was born with a penis and assigned sex of male at birth, and actually served as a GI before taking off to Europe to pursue sex reassignment. And if I got the story right, she didn't tell her family or her loved ones what she was going off to Europe to do. She had found this doctor who was willing and very interested to administer hormone therapy and later surgery. And the family didn't know that George had now become Christine until, I believe, she wrote a letter home, right? Announcing right. that she had made this change and then just sort of showed up, came back home as Christine. Do you know how the family and loved ones responded to that?
You know, they were, as far as I can tell, the response was fairly positive. There was not the kind of, you know, shock that you might have expected to the degree that there was negative emotions involved. There may have been at some personal level that may not have been documented, but her parents stuck by her. And, you know, even to the very end, it was really remarkable, I think. And, you know, just looking at the letter, I can read it, just the quotes from it, because it's so powerful. Right as you say, before she came back, and she wrote a letter saying, "I have changed very much, as my photos will show, but I want you to know that I'm an extremely happy person, and that the real me, not the physical me, has not changed." She wrote, "Nature made a mistake, which I have corrected, and I am now your daughter." So wow. Pretty powerful, yeah.
Wow. You know, in some ways, the story is a kind of, as many of these stories, a kind of timestamp that shows us how much things have changed since then. But, you know, I got to say, in some ways or in other ways, it makes me wonder how much things have or have not changed, because the European doctors felt obligation to treat Jorgensen because it would be wrong to let her live in such anguish any longer. That's really progressive even right now. I mean, even now there are still doctors who, when they're approached by the child and parents where the child is adamant about transitioning, some doctors adopt the wait and see model, or even worse, adopt the you can do whatever you want until you're 18 model. And they don't show the same kind of unwavering support as did Jorgensen's doctors back then. I wonder what you think about that.
Right. I mean, I think it's really, you know, the field evolves in these fits and starts, I guess. And in her case, she knew she had to leave the U.S. to get that treatment. And now there does seem to be, I mean, clearly, I think what people now have that they didn't have in her era, as I mentioned, is just this openness, at least, to talk about it, and people can go on the internet and find support groups or you know, point to these people who have pioneered this area for them that have come out and spoken publicly about it. And I mentioned a few other people in the book that are really open about what they went through. So today that's a big change in terms of treatment. I guess it's just an evolution that sometimes can be slower than it should be, but there's also careful consideration. And I think that makes sense in a case like this to make sure that the person is really well evaluated and that there's careful thought about treatment. So I guess sometimes that can go one way or the other in terms of how slow or fast it happens.
You know, one of the things that I think you do really well in the book, and consistently in every single chapter, is describe the figure's childhood, the where they were born, where they grew up, who the parents were, what the parents' upbringings were like even. I mean, you take a really thorough history, maybe more thorough than some therapists would, which is really great. Why did you feel it was important to include a thorough review of their childhood? And I'm wondering if there was a particular figure whose childhood really stood out to you.
Right. Well, I know from reporting and talking to the experts and reading about all of these conditions that, you know, the impact of childhood experiences is very, very important. And even in just reading about the conditions, let's say borderline personality disorder, that childhood experiences came up, or depression, you know, from reading the medical literature that loss of a parent, for example, in early childhood can lead to depression or anxiety later in life. Abraham Lincoln had that experience. He lost his mother when he was very young, and as did Charles Darwin, who lost his mother as a child. So that seemed to affect them in a way and be one of the components of what, you know, who they were as they grew. And in terms of the one that seemed really to resonate is this borderline personality case, which is Marilyn Monroe. And there are many experts in the field who have looked at Marilyn Monroe and said she is, you know, really a case study for this condition. And she had such a difficult childhood. So she was born and really given up within a couple of weeks of her birth to a foster family. Her mother, who it turns out suffered from mental health issues herself, could not take care of Marilyn, who was named Norma Jean as a baby and as a child. She went to the foster family. She stayed with them for about 7 years. Her mother would come visit her, but didn't. There was some confusion there early on as to who that was, and she didn't feel. She talked about not ever being Marilyn Monroe herself. Talked about not feeling that embrace of family, that love. When she was about seven, her mother took her home, tried to keep her in the home with her. Had a breakdown within some number of months after Marilyn or Norma Jean came back. And as a child, Marilyn Monroe watched her mother have this breakdown, coming down the steps in the house, and then be taken off to a hospital where she was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And, you know, she talked about how she at some point said, "I seem to be a whole superstructure with no foundation." Mm-hmm. She didn't have that scaffolding within her to grab onto. She looked constantly. What was her identity? Who was she? She found it on the stage. But that was, you know, think about that. I mean, that was the stage. That was the limelight. That was the people watching you. But behind that, she didn't have that kind of that foundation. And she sought it out. And so it seemed that a lot of this came from this very troubled and difficult childhood where she did not have stable relationships. She did not feel the love. She talked about wanting, you know, those hugs and kisses and the love that she didn't get. And it left this hole. And so to me, that was such an important story in terms of how childhood can shape the way a person feels about him or herself.
You know, I want to bring attention to a specific aspect of Marilyn Monroe's story. First of all, borderline personality disorder is a diagnosis that sometimes people throw it around, but casually, but it is a very serious condition, and it really is marked by an intense instability of self and instability in relationships, a lack of felt connection or solid connection with others. But, you know, in my experience, I've also learned that a lot of times with borderline personality disorder, people with this disorder, for them, being believed is a core issue. Many of these patients, they come in not only with horrible experiences, as did Marilyn Monroe, but with a history of either not being believed by others or of having their version of reality sort of challenged by the people who perpetrated those experiences. I think you kind of hint at that in your depiction of Marilyn Monroe, that even though Monroe said that she had been abused, I can't remember if it was by her uncle or by a foster father or who it was. But if I read correctly, you seem to hint that people didn't always believe Marilyn Monroe or thought that she exaggerated her traumas. Do you know if she felt like nobody believed her?
That's a great question. I think she felt very frustrated, and I would imagine it's probably not a stretch to say that she may have had that feeling. She didn't get the treatment, you know, that she would get now. I mean, that's a really interesting piece of the whole story of Marilyn Monroe. The point you make about not being believed, when I talked to one of the experts I talked to said, you know, it's so important to validate the experiences because borderline patients are often not treated as equals. So people will tiptoe around them and not really, they were considered sort of the hot potato patient. Nobody wanted to treat them because they're so difficult, certainly back in the day. And this clinician told me that, you know, treating them as equals and validating those experiences is very important to the patient. It's sort of rewarding to them. At the end of the day, my experience reporting this, what I found out about the treatment was that, you know, doing that and acknowledging the past experiences is critical, but then so is moving on and trying to give patients skills that can help them get through day to day, you know, treat them as an equal and say, yes, you suffered, and there's no doubt about that. Now let's figure out a way that you, you know, you, a person who can do this, you can do this, and let's give you some skills. So you have much more experience than I do in terms of treating patients, but that was what I had taken in from the experts I spoke to, and it's just such an interesting piece of the whole story.
You know, it seems to me that this book, I don't know how you'll feel about this, but that this book might also be kind of a statement on the dangers of celebrity, because one of the things I took away is that in many of the cases, it seems like someone's celebrity status led to much enabling. You know, I'm thinking about Betty Ford, how her doctors never said no to her, Andy Warhol and all his rules, his entourages, and even Frank Lloyd Wright and his devoted followers, the people who stuck by him, even when he didn't pay them. Even Diana seems to have been done in large part because the public needed to see her in a certain way. Do you have a thought after doing all this research and writing this book about celebrity and whether it might have, how it affected the course of these people's lives and of their condition?
Yes, I think that is so important. And it really does come out in a number of these cases, and it's so unfortunate. But being a celebrity, of course, gives you this sort of level of fame and this level of sort of hands off, because there you are at this height of power and achievement and everything else. You mentioned Betty Ford, and there, you know, I remember, I talk about in the chapter how she felt that, you know, doctors gave her more medication, more pain medication, which she was becoming addicted to because they didn't want to say no. In Howard Hughes's case, he had these issues with obsessive compulsive disorder, terrible, terrible obsessions, and compulsive behaviors. And, one of the doctors I spoke to about his case said, you know, most people who suffer from OCD need to earn a paycheck and support their family and deal with life. They have to function somehow. I mean, they have to figure out a way to function. Whereas Howard Hughes, you know, he, by the end of his life, holed up in his sort of caves he created with these rules and regulations about how to open a can of fruit. And the people who served him and worked for him did this because it was Howard Hughes and he was telling them, and they had to do it. Frank Lloyd Wright, as you mentioned, with his, what I talked about, narcissism with him, narcissistic personality disorder, doing what he demanded, despite the sort of overriding sense of sort of, I'm right and you're wrong, because of his achievements and his fame and everything that, you know, even the clients living in his homes who were told, not, you know, don't bring your own furniture, don't hang stuff on the wall, it's all the way I design it, and sort of catering to those demands. So I think that is a really, really important underlying point. And it's hard to know, what do you do about that? How do you, you'd be a lucky celebrity to get a really honest treatment, both from a clinician or professional, as well as from the people around you.
You know, I'm curious about Howard Hughes a little bit more, because for those who don't know, he had what we would now call OCD. I'm not sure that was available, that diagnosis, that concept was available to him at the time. But for people who may not be familiar, he did not have what we would call OCPD, which is obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is kind of a milder form of OCD. And the kind of thing that lots of people have and that they jokingly call OCD. No, Howard Hughes had the more severe version and had some real serious symptoms. What were the symptoms that stood out to you the most?
Well, he was very, very fearful or obsessive about germs. I mean, he had a very, very difficult time with things coming in and you know, making him sick, and taping up windows and doing stuff with masking tape. He had Kleenex was his big defense against the world. And he wrote these memos to people about what they needed to do. He had a hearing aid that he wore. He had a little bit of a hearing issue, and there was a memo about, here's how you take the hearing aid cord out of the bathroom cabinet. And he had to use something like 15 Kleenexes you know, between opening the doorknob and grabbing the thing. And newspapers had to come to him in a stack of three so that he could take the middle one, which wouldn't have been infected with anything. And that way it would, you know, keep him clean. So his overriding issue seemed to be concern about germs and pollution, you know, to him. I was looking at the chapter again, and I could read a couple of lines too from there just about.
Yes, please.
You know, he had these painstaking instructions, which included a 3-page memo on how to open a can of fruit. So here's a little bit that's, you know, from the book. One step required that his assistants wash the can with soap first and then scrub it, quote, from a point 2 inches below the top of the can. The label was to be soaked and removed, the can cleaned with a sterile brush over and over until all particles of dust, pieces of paper label, and in general, all sources of contamination have been removed. Serving the fruit mandated a new set of rules requiring the server to always keep his head and upper body at least 1 foot away from the can and to present it with, quote, absolutely no talking, coughing, clearing of the throat, or any movement whatsoever of the lips. So you get a sense of how intense this was and how absolutely sort of just paralyzing the whole thing was. And the people who served him did it.
Wow. Well, what makes OCD unique is that the people who have it and who perform these kinds of rituals, they usually know that their rituals and the beliefs underlying them are irrational, and they feel trapped because they want to stop it. They know how nonsensical it is, and that yet they can't help it. Do we know if that's the case with Howard Hughes? Do we know if he knew how irrational and over the top this was?
Yeah, that's a little bit mysterious with Hughes, although it's clear that, you know, it was very clear to people around him, and he seemed so you know, paralyzed by it. That's hard to imagine. He didn't have, you know, understand to some degree what was happening. He didn't leave behind. I couldn't find anything. I don't know that there is anything where he actually expresses that himself, but there also isn't a lot that he left behind like that. So there were these memos that exist, but there wasn't a lot personally coming from him on how he assessed what was going on. But it seemed like it just seemed that there had to be some level of understanding as he watched his life. He became so reclusive and so completely isolated by this. But it's a thing I'd like to learn more about, in fact, because how much is there a way to find out how much he knew? I couldn't determine that for sure.
So who else stood out to you?
Wow, so many of them. And Warhol, the title character of the book, Andy Warhol, was a hoarder. You know, he stood out because there were so many things I didn't know about him and so many things I didn't appreciate about him. He also had a troubled childhood in the sense that he was a sickly kid. He spent a lot of time at home. He was not comfortable in social situations. He had physical things that bothered him. He had difficulty with his skin. And he ended up, you know, being this unbelievable, you know, his art was revolutionary in the sense of transforming this whole pop art thing that he did. I did not know that he left behind about 600 boxes of stuff. And these are all at the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh. And it's a wonderful place to visit if anybody has the time to go. And you can see remnants of a lot of these boxes. I went myself to where they actually took one of the boxes onto a stage at the museum, and they opened it up as if it was sort of like a scene out of a magic show, where they had a couple of catalogers up there who had blue gloves on. They were, you know, going to go into this box and pull things out of this box. And so there it was up on the stage, and they started pulling these things out. And he left behind everything from old Christmas cards to toothbrush boxes, pizza dough, past due bills, anything and everything in these boxes that he sort of swept stuff off of his desk and threw it in there. And then beyond that, left his townhouse after he died, was found to just contain rooms where you couldn't enter. They were so cluttered and crowded, 175 cookie jars. He was an absolute collector to the point of no return. And in his case, talking about something bothering you, he actually acknowledged that he didn't like the clutter. He said at some point, I think everyone should live in a big, empty space. It can be a small space as long as it's clean and empty. He wrote this in one of his works and said at some point, I'm so sick of the way I live, of all the junk and always dragging more home. And yet he felt this, whatever, this compulsion to do it. He collected not only things and stuff, but he collected conversations. He taped everyday conversations and amassed hours and hours of these tapes. And I sort of made the observation as I was reading about him and learning about him that he even, you know, he collected, everything was about numbers and multitudes with him. He went around with these entourages of people. It was always these groups. And then in his work, he produced these multiple images. It just, there was sort of this need, you know, to be somehow surrounded by stuff, by multitudes, by a lot of things. So I was really surprised by the level to which he did hoard and did struggle to some degree with that.
And I guess like with Howard Hughes or like with people who complain of their OCD symptoms, with Andy Warhol, what you said is one of the things that fascinated me the most, that he knew that this was impeding his life and that he wanted or wished that he could do without these things, and yet he couldn't. So that, I kind of wondered about that. I'm going to put my psychoanalyst hat on for a moment, if you don't mind, because you mentioned that one interesting aspect of his life is that his mother lived with him for a very long time. I can't remember if it was up until her death, but I started wondering if his conflicted feelings over his material possessions, which he wanted to get rid of but couldn't figure out how to get rid of or couldn't part with, if they were, might somehow have been a displacement of his conflicted feelings over his mother's living with him. A la, I wish I could get rid of her, but I must keep her. Do you have any thoughts about that?
That's so interesting. I think it's a really interesting theory. I would need to do more research into that relationship, which really wasn't, never became that clear to me, other than, yes, she did come to live with him. And even in the early years of his career, was sort of his assistant. She did some of the handwriting on some of his works. She had beautiful handwriting. So he relied on her at some level. And yet he had this very colorful other life that, you know, really was so secretive at some level and yet so flamboyant at other levels, in terms of the parties and the going down to Studio 54 and the parties that took place at the factory where he did his artwork. So, yeah, I mean, I could see there being, yes, you know, was it a good thing that she was there until her death for so many years? I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about too, when he talked about he had this tape recorder I mentioned about taping these conversations, and he called it that. He said he was married to it, and he called that tape recorder his wife. Mm-hmm. It was almost as if, and he said, in fact, the acquisition of my tape recorder really finished whatever emotional life I might have had, but I was glad to see it go. I guess that's when he it was like these things replaced his emotional complex feelings or whatever. But a lot of really interesting stuff there, and I like your theory. I mean, it seems like it could be true.
Why did you pick him as the title character?
Well, we had a lot of discussion about the title, and the idea was to get a person's name and a condition, so that it was clear to people picking up the book that this was going to be a book about a person, a life, as well as a condition. And at the end of the day, his name resonates in a very contemporary way to some degree, so that people can very clearly envision Andy Warhol and his art. And hoarding is a more contemporary diagnosis, so it's only recently become an actual diagnosis in if you're looking at the DSM. So those two things made it kind of a lively title versus something like Lincoln and his depression or Howard Hughes and OCD. Andy Warhol was a hoarder, gives you that very immediate sense of what the book is sort of trying to get at. It's a catchy title. I don't think it really tells the story of the book in the sense that it's catchy, not serious, but it sort of gets at the idea. So people will pick up the book, say, oh, what is this? And then maybe start reading it.
I agree. It's a very catchy title. One of the things that I think the book also helps us to understand is that having some kind of, and I kind of don't like this word, but having some kind of condition or some kind of unique way that your psychology is organized, it has its downsides, but it also has its upsides. Is there a particular person in the book that helps illustrate that point, that some people actually had special gifts because of their condition?
Yes, and I love this whole piece of the book and the study of all of this, because I think it's so important for people to take away from learning about these conditions and how there is this sort of duality that comes with it. So a number of them show this. I studied George Gershwin, and I write about him after seeing a psychiatrist in New York who is both a psychiatrist as well as a Juilliard-trained pianist who does these wonderful performances of composers, where he looks at the minds of composers. And one of the ones he looked at is Gershwin. And he proposed this theory that if Gershwin were around today as a young child in kindergarten, exhibiting the behaviors he did as a young child, he would almost certainly be referred to a child counselor, or a child psychologist, who would probably have assessed him for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. And this is because Gershwin was a rambunctious child. He didn't sit still. He skipped school. He got into street fights. He didn't always do his homework. He didn't pay attention. All of these characteristics that people recognize today as possible characteristics of ADHD. So there's no saying here that he had it. It's just this interesting theory. And it speaks to the way we live now, that had he been alive today, he probably would have been assessed and he might have been diagnosed. But when you think about Gershwin's energy, he lived a very short life. He died in his 30s. But his extraordinary energy, which never abated, he would tap dance while he was waiting for elevators. He cracked peanuts during rehearsals. He could not stop moving. He stayed up late. A lot of the times he would write and play into the night. He poured that energy. It came frantically through his head. Sometimes he said he couldn't catch the ideas fast enough. But look what he produced. I mean, he left behind hundreds of pieces of music and composition. And so in his case, you could argue that abundant energy served his creativity. So I think that's one example that I find really interesting. Another one is Abraham Lincoln, who many people have theorized about depression. And Lincoln himself talked about being melancholy. The memories of him at the time by his contemporaries talk about him as this extraordinarily melancholy guy. And he struggled with suicide attempts early in life. All sorts of characteristics that some people believe may have been clinical depression. And yet at the same time, there's interesting thoughts about how depression can sometimes give you these insights. It can make you more realistic. It can make you more sympathetic. It can make you more of a clear thinker on some of the negative things that he encountered and dealt with, like the Civil War. So maybe that those depressive qualities that he endured also gave him this clarity. And in fact, with Lincoln, some of the ways he got through it, one of the ways was he was a phenomenal storyteller, and he was very funny, and he used humor as a way, as he said, to quote, vent his moods. He turned to humor, and he enriched other people's lives through that. And he also turned to work. He talked about work is what you do when you get down. And so he poured himself into being president, to doing what he needed to do to making himself this incredible public figure. So in that case, you know, that was really interesting to me. Then there's Darwin, who I wrote about anxiety. He was diagnosed with a million, you know, by many different conditions, but anxiety seemed to pervade his life. And in his case, the perfectionism and the sort of rumination that came with some of those issues also contributed to the quality of his work. I mean, he responded to some degree to that anxiety by making sure everything he wrote about in The Origin of Species was accurate and it was backed up and he knew what he was talking about, all that stuff. So there are these qualities that motivated him to some degree. You could be paralyzed by fear, or you can be motivated, and that concept that too little is not good and too much is not good, but maybe somewhere in between is actually somewhere positive. So I found that really incredibly interesting in so many of these stories.
Those are three very interesting figures, and I want to share something going back to George Gershwin. When I read that chapter, you know, with all of them, I noticed that reading your chapters made me want to go online and learn more about these people. And with George Gershwin, as I was reading the chapter, I wanted to hear the music again. And so I actually went into my music and I found Rhapsody in Blue. And I read the chapter while listening to Rhapsody in Blue in the background. And I really recommend that to our listeners and to your readers to do that, because when I did that, I suddenly got it on a visceral level. I got how possibly chaotic his mind could feel and how quickly it moved and how quickly he would change direction, and yet how beautiful it was, and how even in that chaos and the noise there was something very valuable and very beautiful that could come from it. And I'm really glad that the world got to see that. Have you had a similar experience listening to his music?
Oh, yeah. I, in fact, also was listening to it while I was writing, and I couldn't help but be inspired by it. And hearing all of the buildup in that piece to the sort of frenetic, almost at times, pace of it. It's just really so inspiring, and it really does speak to that. It's as if you can almost relive Gershwin himself and envision him playing it and hearing that. And I think that in his case, that creativity and that abundant energy just all kind of whirled together in this way that produced this wonderful music that we can all listen to now and still enjoy. And I agree, everybody should listen to it. It's just wonderful.
Do you think, he didn't have a diagnosis of ADHD at the time, because that diagnosis was not available to him then. And, sometimes diagnoses come with a stigma as well as the advantage of having a name for what you're going through. So it's got pluses and minuses. Do you think if he would have had a diagnosis of ADHD, a name for it, do you think he would have been as successful as, do you think he would have been as inspiring?
It's such a good question. It's such an important question. I think you can look at it in different ways. I think, if you're a child, like, let's say he's the child with the diagnosis, and then let's say he gets prescribed medication, Ritalin or some other medication to help him focus. Would then that energy become to a degree that the music would not have been as abundantly energetic as it was? I mean, it's a question we'll never know. I mean, I even pose it in the book. Would we have Rhapsody in Blue if he'd been diagnosed and treated, today? I think, I've talked to experts who talk themselves. I mean, a number of people in these fields suffer themselves or have these conditions themselves. And we'll talk about the great value of treatment, of diagnosis, of doing that so that they can then achieve their own work themselves. And so I think it's always going to be, it almost has to be a case of individual situation. I would worry that had he gotten a diagnosis, that it may have, he may not have worked as quickly as he did, or he may not have gotten to the point of sort of doing what he needed to do, because maybe that would have been an interruption that might not have kept him going on his sort of frenetic journey to produce music. So on the other hand, people suffer and struggle with conditions that can be treated, and in some cases by medication, in some cases not. And they have told me that not treating isn't an option, that the reason they are able to produce and do their work in the field is because they are diagnosed and they are treated. So I think it depends on the condition, on the level of impairment of the condition, and then on how it's treated.
I feel like this issue kind of comes up with Albert Einstein as well, because by today's standards, he might meet criteria for Asperger's, even though we don't technically use that word anymore. But it sort of raises the question, For whom was his isolation a problem? Was it a problem for him, or was it a problem for those around him? Because the same thing, would he have been able to produce the brilliant work that he did had he been, quote unquote, treated for his condition? And you also write in the book that currently there are people in the Asperger's community that are a bit afraid about the neurological genetic possibilities for preventing Asperger's, because that might get rid of an entire community of geniuses. What do you think about that?
Right. I think that also is really interesting with Einstein. He did have these moments, many moments of just complete sort of withdrawal into his head. And there were all these recollections about that. There was an artist I wrote about in the book who went to visit him to do a painting of him, and how he was so inside his head, he barely noticed this guy was there. There was just kind of he was disheveled. He wasn't prepared for encountering another human being. He was in his head completely. Family members described that about him. And yet that was where he did his work. That was how he made those connections that got us to the theory of relativity, got him to the theory of relativity for the rest of us. And so I think it's a really important, question to ask. How do you assess a situation like that? And Asperger's, like any of these conditions, everything is on a spectrum or a continuum. And so where, if it is affecting the person's life and they are unable to be functioning in the world and they are miserably isolated and all of those things, then I think you look at it one way. With Einstein, we talked about indulgence before with Hughes and others. With Einstein, there was some level of that too, in the sense that not necessarily in a negative way, but he was helped along. So with things that he was not good at, which included he wasn't very tactful a lot of the time, and he would get lost walking home from work at Princeton. And he, I mentioned he was disheveled. He didn't care about his public appearance. And there are a lot of really interesting recollections of people helping him, his wife reminding him to change his pants or bring a new pair of pants on his trip. And the secretary at his assistant at Princeton, sometimes going out and guiding him back to the house, that there were ways in which he was helped along. And had he not been so brilliant and dealt with some of these same characteristics, how would he have gotten to where he got to? So these are all questions, I think, in some ways unanswerable. And I really think in each case, it's such an individual case. But I think no matter what, every instance has to be very carefully thought through and very carefully studied, so that there's not a knee-jerk reaction to either assign a diagnosis or assign a treatment or whatever it might be.
We could talk for hours longer about all of these folks. But I think what I really want to know now, Claudia, is whether you what have you learned, or how have you been changed in some way by doing this research and writing this book?
Well, I learned just an enormous amount about the struggles that human beings go through, that there are hidden stories everywhere, that we are all connected to our own internal dramas in some way and to each other, that people are often misjudged, that people are often stigmatized, and that is just so terrible. It should not be. That there's a lot of fear around mental health conditions, and news headlines often provoke that, that there's a lot of educating to do, that in terms of encountering readers, people are, I do book talks and people come up to me and are desperate to share stories. They want to talk about themselves or the family member who struggles with one or more of these conditions. And it's a burden to bear for everybody. And I think public airing of this is only a good thing. It can be done in an irresponsible way. I tried hard to do it in a really responsible way, but I think the end result of talking about these issues is a step toward chipping away at that stigma, better understanding, better just really recognition about the struggles we all face at the end of the day. So I could go on too. There's so much I learned, but it was really really enriching, and really, and also in some ways, and readers have told me this too, it was to some degree comforting, because I think especially you think about things like social media these days and Facebook. If you go on these things, you get a sense that people's lives are all rosy and wonderful, and they're off on their next vacation to the Bahamas, and they're posting their children's photos, and they're giving you a superficial sense of life that it's all wonderful, and they're highlighting these moments, and we can embrace that and love that. But you know, you're not hearing a lot about what goes on underneath, and there's a lot of that too. And the struggles are what define us to some degree. And so I think that is all what I learned.
As did I. It really was an excellent book, and I'm so glad that you wrote it. Before we go, what are you working on now?
No, I'm looking at all sorts of aspects that come out of this book that I'm interested in. So I'm interested in, you mentioned autism and some of the issues around that. I'm interested in Savant syndrome, this idea that there are some people who have autism or characteristics, but then also have these incredibly brilliant capacities. I'm really interested in that. I'm looking at prodigies and how, what happens, what goes on there? Why does some people excel early in life? And I'm interested in all sorts of themes that come out of this book. And I'm working also on some freelance stories and thinking about a next book.
That sounds like a really interesting project, the idea of the Savant. So definitely I will want to hear about that once it's finished. Again, the book is called Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Great Personalities, published by the National Geographic Society in 2016 by Claudia Kalb. Claudia, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it greatly as well.